The following content has been provided by New St. Andrews College in Moscow, Idaho. For more information, visit us online at nsa.edu.
As one very wise person once put it, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. In no area is this adage more true than in the realm of humanitarian disasters. By humanitarian disasters, I mean not volcanoes, not earthquakes, but rather man-made famines, man-made political calamities, refugees from war, humanitarian disasters, but most specifically, disasters that are the result of someone trying to do good to somebody, or in the name of doing good. Whenever someone proposes good deeds on a grand scale, one of the assumptions that goes into it is the assumption that, if implemented, nothing can possibly go wrong. Since nothing can go wrong, then we never have to worry about who bears the costs, if it goes wrong. Since we never have to worry about who bears the costs, we can press for our solution to the crisis we are in. We are eating in the restaurant of good intentions, where no one ever has to pick up the tab. So, all we do is just tennis shoe it out of here. That word solution is important in this, as is the word crisis. As Thomas Sowell points out in his admirable book, The Vision of the Anointed, progressives like to think in terms of quote-unquote solutions. Those who do not share the progressive vision think in terms of trade-offs. So the conservative frame of mind thinks in terms of trade-offs. The progressive frame of mind thinks in terms of solutions. A problem arises or is assumed to have arisen, and because we want to generate a panicked sense of the need to act now, we call it a crisis. Global warming is a crisis, I tell you, and no, we can't study it for 100 years. We have to act now. We should have acted yesterday, people. Nothing illustrates the pathetic nature of the modern Republican Party better than a television commercial I saw once with Nancy Pelosi and Newt Gingrich telling us that the one thing they can agree on is the need for concerted action to address climate change. Actually, pathetic is far too insipid a word. But this lecture, this talk, this podcast is not about climate change. While the crises change and the nouns and verbs change, the drill is always the same. The other team wears different jerseys in different games, depending on which Saturday night it is, but they always run the same plays. And so that's what we're dealing with when we're dealing with, doing good on a grand scale. They're always running the same play. So when N.T. Wright, for example, addresses the problem of third world debt, he is looking for a solution to the problem. He wants a solution. What would actually happen, were such forgiveness to occur, forgiveness of third world debts. Were such forgiveness to occur, what would actually happen would be a series of cascading trade-offs. And if any of those trade-offs were to cause serious dislocations, problems, or disasters, as I'm arguing they most certainly would, those who are earlier pressing for solutions don't know about it. They don't think that way. They did not anticipate that possible outcome, so they're not here checking to see what might have happened. They did not know that in this restaurant, the waiter eventually presents the bill. They had another appointment that was pressing, and so, as I said, they tennis shoot it out of here. No arrangements have been made to ensure that those who were wrong might bear any portion of the cost of being wrong. And the last thing in this fallen world, the last thing you want are people making decisions who bear no share of the consequences if they were wrong. The cost in their world, the cost of being wrong, will always be borne by somebody else. Now, of course, when any group of people is suffering under the costs of a previous generation's reforming zeal, a new batch of reformers can always bustle up and propose new solutions for them, and they frequently will. But they do not see the interconnectedness of any of this. They have no sense of history. They do not see themselves in a story. They have no imagination. So, what do I mean by trade-offs? $1 billion is extended in debt forgiveness. That's a sum that has trade-offs in three possible directions: where it is going, where it comes from, and where it did not go when it otherwise could have. So there's $1 billion that's going somewhere, there's $1 billion that's coming from somewhere, and there's $1 billion that's not going where it otherwise would have gone. We've already addressed the possible problem of where it could go, keeping a dictator in power, for example, feeding his army. So you offer debt forgiveness, and instead of feeding the people, he keeps his army on the march. We've also touched on the problem of the unwilling donors, investors in irresponsible banks, taxpayers who have to bail out irresponsible banks, or taxpayers who have to bail out wicked countries directly via foreign aid. The money they lose is money they cannot use. Had that $1 billion remained with the original owners, they would have had the use of it. All the good that would have been done by that means will not now be done. But that missing good cannot be photographed, televised, or interviewed because it didn't happen. And it is similar with the $1 billion that, had it remained safely invested with the banks, could have been loaned to entities that would have been a good risk and would have provided a good return on it. What would they have done with it? Who would have been employed as a result of that? Who would have been fed as a result of wise investments? We shall never know. They will never be interviewed. There will never be any kind of report on that. Now, this does not mean that we should never write off a bad debt, or that debt forgiveness is automatically a bad thing. It's not. But whenever we take action like this, it is paramount that we understand what we're doing. We should have examined the trade-offs and determined carefully that this is the action we should take. But the tunnel vision of do-gooding solutions does not understand this at all. They only see unmitigated good coming from good intentions, and they chafe whenever anybody asks or raises pointed questions. Those who raise questions must be perverse somehow. Why do you hate the poor so much? Hating the poor being equated with getting underfoot when invincible good deeds are in process. Here's another example. Take the goodness of greenness. Take the goodness of going green. There are many things that are exasperating about the soi-disant stewards of the environment, but the central exasperating thing about them lies right at the heart of their claim. This is especially true of Christians who tell us that Jesus requires us to be stewards of the earth, and that being green is a spiritual value. And so it is. The problem is that the greens always turn everything brown. And here's why. Well, one of the reasons is that the substance that turns plants green is CO2. And they have declared war on CO2, declaring it a pollutant. Well, there's more involved than that. The Greek word for steward is oikonomos. A word from which we get economy and economics and all the rest of those dismal words. A steward provides household law. He's the one who keeps track of things, or is supposed to. So a steward managing a household, he keeps the books, he has the ledger, and that's the law of the household. That's the rule of the house. Luke 16:1 and 2 says, "And he said also unto his disciples, There was a certain man which had a steward, and the same was accused unto him that he had wasted his goods. And he called him, and said unto him, How is it that I hear this of thee? Give an account of thy stewardship, for thou mayest no longer be steward." So the ability to give a reckoning, to give an account, to show the column of numbers, to show your work, is right at the heart of stewardship. Now, when modern Christians talk about stewardship of the earth, they are almost always talking about cultivating feelings of general benevolence, coupled with good intentions that desire a good and a green outcome. Let's grow happy thoughts. This cultivation is expressed by making a law in favor of the contemporary cause du jour, without any regard for what this does everywhere else in the system as the result of the trade-offs. This is like a bookkeeper who makes an entry in the ledger in one place without any awareness of the fact that this will affect his columns of numbers everywhere else in the ledger. He eventually turns the page and is surprised, astonished, flummoxed. He promises congressional hearings, the kind of hearing that is guaranteed always to leave the real culprits alone. This is because the real culprits are the ones holding the hearings, which is kind of convenient, come to think of it. The last thing these people have on their minds is an accounting, and the last thing they are prepared to do is give an actual accounting. But that is what stewardship is, accounting. Apart from a genuine free market, it is not possible to give an accounting. in a nation where the resources and the environment that contains those resources are all managed by the government, stewardship is a conceptual impossibility. This is because when the markets are not free, nobody knows the true price of anything. When the markets are not free, nobody knows what it costs. Nobody knows what the true price is. When no one knows the true price of anything, this removes intelligent incentives and it creates a host of perverse incentives. The only kind of stewardship possible is legal perverse stewardship or illegal honest stewardship. So it's either a black market with illegal honest stewardship or it's bureaucratic stewardship which specializes in dishonesty. Remember, the rule of law is not making something legal. The rule of law is a constant and it governs the refs as well as the players. If refs can change the rules of the game in the course of the game, that is not the rule of law, not even if the ref blew his whistle when he did it. Imagine a gigantic yard sale covering five suburban households, five suburban yards. Suppose further that none of those working the sale were allowed to put a price tag on anything. Most things were still for sale, and those that were not for sale were put off limits according to their whims by about three policemen who were wandering back and forth through the sale, swinging their billy clubs. Now, get a megaphone, stand on a nearby porch, and urge everybody to be good stewards. Hernando de Soto has shown in his book, marvelous book, The Mystery of Capital, that third world nations have plenty of resources, plenty of wealth. It is available and near at hand. What they don't have is the rule of law and the attendant concept of clear title. When no one has clear title, there's no basis for the generation of wealth and no basis for stewardship of the resultant wealth. Now, what I'm about to say may seem a bit radical, so let me begin with a biblical illustration of the principle. The Bible says that a man who does not discipline his son hates his son, Proverbs 13:24. This hatred is objective, measured by the results. It is not subjective. That is, it does not key off the emotional state of the father who is doing this awful thing to his son. He's probably a bleeding heart father and not a hater in that sense. But he still hates his son, according to this proverb. If he doesn't discipline his son, however sentimental he is, however emotional he is, he still hates his son. In that spirit, with that qualification, it has to be said that environmentalists hate the environment, in just the same way that statists and liberals hate the poor. They talk like nobody's business. Their phylacteries are wide and they give lengthy prayers in the synagogues. They are the worst. They tie heavy burdens on the backs of others, which neither they nor their cronies are willing to bear themselves. They are false. They are wrong. They are hypocrites. And Christians who parrot their line are in rebellion against the very idea of stewardship. They hate it. They don't want to give an accounting of just how it is that they destroy the environment and bring about the extinction of species. They don't care. All they want to do is roll their eyes when you come in and ask to see the books. Books? We don't want books. We don't want to reckon. We don't want to count. All we want is a law that guarantees a fine result, with birds chirping in the trees with a blue sky and fluffy clouds. But stewardship looks at the results. A review of stewardship asks to see the books. But these fuzzy benevolent stewards want an accounting department that never has to add up any numbers. Numbers are tiring. Numbers make my head hurt. Numbers aren't very green. Right, they want accounting without counting. And people who think that like that are terrible stewards. Every resource in this world has a true price. Every resource in this world has a true price. That is the price established for it by the hand of God when men and women are trading peacefully and not thieving from one another. The legalization of this thievery, which many professing Christians are muddled enough to advocate, destroys the rule of law and introduces thuggery to the management of that yard sale we talked about a moment ago. They want to make it legal for the cops to club anyone who tries to sell something that would be bad for global warming. Later on this afternoon, they will be clubbing those who sell items that will accelerate the undeniable threat of global cooling. They don't care about the results, just so long as they get to club somebody.
New St. Andrews College, thanks you for listening.